This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, how are you? My name's Charlie McKillop. In the next hour, the death of 18 head of cattle in central Queensland, a tick fever, has confirmed the worst fears of producers about changes to the rules around moving cattle across the tick line. And shareholders at AACo have had their first opportunity to front the board of the company since the extent of losses at its ill-fated Darwin abattoir were revealed. And when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Producers around the tropical or not-so-tropical north are offloading cattle by the truckload as water supplies run dry.
I'm frantically, and a lot of neighbours are frantically resurrecting all our bores and making sure they're all working properly, and we're going to totally rely on bores later in the year.
But first up on the Country Hour today, a Gold Coast bait supplier has become the first to be prosecuted for moving raw prawns outside of a movement restriction area imposed to stop the spread of white spot syndrome virus. The disease is responsible for wiping out prawn farms on the Logan River, just south of Brisbane, and samples taken from the wild have tested positively as recently as 2 months ago. The offender's been fined $10,000 in the Brisbane Magistrates Court after a sample picked up very soon after the control order was imposed tested positive to white spot. Queensland's Chief Biosecurity Officer, Malcolm Letts, told me he hopes it's a penalty that will send a clear message to others contemplating breaching that control order, which extends from Caloundra to the New South Wales border and west to Ipswich.
In the early stages of the outbreak, we were doing quite a bit of surveillance work. This is good news from our point of view in relation to the first time we've had a successful prosecution underneath the new Biosecurity Act. And the magistrate made special mention of the general biosecurity obligation and its importance in relation to the legislation. And this is really the message that we wanted to send, that ignorance isn't really a defence in relation to the general biosecurity obligation. Everyone has a part to play and need to understand that.
Well, what else do you know about the circumstances?
There's the full transcript in relation to the court proceedings which we have, which includes the details from the person who was prosecuted in relation to what their understanding was of their entitlements and why they did what they did. So, yeah, we've got a pretty clear picture of what's happened.
And what was the bait supplier's understanding of his or her obligations under the Biosecurity Act?
Well, our understanding was that the prawns were collected prior to the movement control orders being put in place, and that the operator thought that that meant that he was excluded from the movement control order restrictions.
Obviously, this case does highlight the severe economic impact of the trade restrictions being imposed on those commercial operators who can't send their seafood, uncooked seafood anyway, outside of the movement control area. Under those circumstances, Malcolm Letts, can you understand why a bait supplier in this situation might have resorted to flouting the law?
I'm not sure that's the circumstance we're looking at here, and we're talking very early in the response, Charlie, and it would appear that the operator hadn't done his homework in relation to what he could and couldn't do, and was under the misapprehension in relation to what he could and couldn't do.
Does it bring back into focus in any way the plight of those operators who continue to get no assistance from the state or the federal government in terms of that very real impact of the emergency response to white spot?
I think what it does is it reinforces that we are serious in relation to the movement control order. As I say, this particular case originated well back in the very early stages of the response, so I'm not sure that it brings it back into light. This is a case that's been in the court, has been underway for a little while now.
In relation to white spot in the wild, you've indicated that it is, as a syndrome virus, much less likely to take hold in the wild. How does the surveillance that you've undertaken to date inform your opinion on that?
I'm not sure that I said that it's much less likely to take hold. Evidence internationally in relation to where white spot has occurred in the wild is that it is very difficult to eradicate once it is in the wild. What we have got, though, is a situation where the only positives we've had to this point in time in the wild are in that northern Moreton Bay area. All of the areas outside the movement control area, outside Moreton Bay, have been clean of in the surveillance work that we've done to this point in time. So that all that tells us at this point in time is that the results we're getting are restricted to the Moreton Bay, the positive results we're getting are restricted to the Moreton Bay zone.
Right, I think, Malcolm, I'm sorry to paraphrase you, I was thinking of the initial interviews that we did in the aftermath of the white spot detection in Moreton Bay, and I thought at the time that you indicated that it promulgates or proliferates much more easily in a more intensive farming type scenario than it does in the wild.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Charlie. So that once you get the virus in a farm situation, because of the nature of the farm and the very high density of animals in the farm, then the virus is a lot more destructive in that environment than it is in the wild. But once the virus is in the wild, a lot like any other viruses that circulate in wild populations or in human populations for that matter, you can get very low levels of prevalence persist for a long period of time.
Right. So if white spot syndrome virus were to be deemed endemic in Australia, in southern Queensland, would that be a precursor for the movement control order becoming a permanent feature of our regulatory landscape?
That's something that would need to be considered by the appropriate national committees that oversee this sort of work. It's a question as much as anything for the trading partners, for the other jurisdictions that we send product to, as it is for us. So you can imagine a scenario where people that are taking prawns from Moreton Bay, and there is wild caught prawns from Moreton Bay, and there is a presence of the virus in Moreton Bay, and it's not anywhere else in Australia, that they would be concerned about taking those prawns uncooked.
You are hearing from Malcolm Letts, the Queensland's Chief Biosecurity Officer. I did just want to bring up one other matter with you in relation to Tropical Race 4. Now, I'm a little red-faced over this one because yesterday on the Country Hour, we effectively re-reported news of another positive case on a banana farm in the Tully Valley. We did so based on a post that we'd picked up on your Biosecurity Queensland Facebook page. Just for the benefit of myself and my listeners, that case that we mentioned yesterday is in fact the one and the same detection that was reported last week. Is that correct?
That's correct, Charlie. We're a little bit red-faced on this as well, because what happened was we just updated a Facebook post, which was an old post, as you say, a couple of weeks old, and what that did was it pushed it to the top of the posts, which was an inadvertent thing that happened on our part. So apologies for that. It is the same infected plant that we reported last week.
So we can agree that it's all Facebook's fault?
Yes.
Okay.
Happy with that.
All right. I shouldn't be flippant, though, because we now have a case of three properties, numerous plants testing positive for TR4. What additional challenge does that present when you're trying to contain the threat from multiple sources, as you currently are?
Yeah, look, the threat of TR4 to the banana industry in far north Queensland shouldn't be underestimated. What we have, though, is a situation where the government, through Biosecurity Queensland and the industry working very closely together, we've managed to contain this disease to a spread that's far slower than anywhere else in the world has experienced. That's through good management practice, good biosecurity practice. I think it's through good on-farm agronomy as well in relation to the way that we grow bananas in Australia. But there's a positive story in relation to the speed of the spread. But let's not forget that this is a insidious disease that is very destructive and impossible to eradicate. So all of the precautionary measures that everyone's putting in place on banana farms in banana regions in North Queensland are really, really important to keep up the effort in that space.
As Queensland's Chief Biosecurity Officer, do you believe we are delaying or beating the disease?
Delaying, I think, is the unfortunate answer to that question.
Yes, there certainly does seem to be a increasing inevitability around these positive cases, which is perhaps why I wasn't as questioning as I should have been when I picked up on your Facebook post yesterday. But thanks very much for coming onto the program today and for clarifying that. Malcolm Letts from Biosecurity Queensland.
Thanks, Charlie.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Queensland cattle producers have been left frustrated and worried about the state government's introduction of new cattle tick management rules as of July 2016 after the recent outbreak of tick fever claimed the lives of 18 head of cattle at Wandowin in central Queensland. There is no longer a requirement for cattle to be inspected and dipped at a clearing station when moved from a tick-infected zone into a tick-free zone across Queensland. Central Queensland grazier Ivan Hay told Jessica Schremer he was shocked about the outbreak of tick fever, which struck on two of his properties between Taroom and Wandowin.
It's been a shock and a surprise because we're in the middle of a tick-free area, and to have something like this happen is just something you never expect.
What do you think was the source of this tick fever outbreak?
We haven't tracked down, and we probably never will be able to, but it's come from two sources. One, sale yards. Two, an infected neighbour that probably even doesn't realise he's infected. We'll just have to do a tick eradication program, same as what we did in the 90s, to get our properties back into a totally free area. It's one of those programs you're just going to have to do, and we're going to have to full burden of the cost.
How much cost is involved with that?
You know, how long's a piece of string? We haven't cleared every property we own yet, so we don't know the full extent of the outbreak. 9 properties. We know it's on 2. We think it could be on up to 4, but we're not sure yet. We have proven it's not on 3 properties, possibly 4. So, yeah, we're only halfway through it.
And you were among the producers who warned the Queensland government 2 years ago about their new legislation and pretty much relaxing the framework of cleaning centres. Why is that?
2 years ago, the government, it's a cost-cutting exercise for the government. I'm not blaming the people that are in DPI or DAF, whatever it's called now. They can only work within the legislation that they've been given. They've taken the DPI inspectors out of it and put a third party in there, or the producers themselves. And, you know, the system was never going to work. It's not working.
And how does that affect the cattle industry?
Our outbreak's probably just the tip of the iceberg. There is a couple of others we've heard of in the last few weeks. I just think when we get a decent season, when the season breaks, you'll find this will be quite common, what's happened to us. And we've got to absorb the cost, and other people will have to, and it will infect the industry. I think that, you know, like these people that are living up our way in a tick-free area, they're all getting nervous. I think they've got to put the emphasis back onto the tick line being controlled and even possibly keep moving it. The industry doesn't need ticks. We don't need ticks. We don't need to be treating cattle with chemicals. We could be chemical-free if we got rid of the ticks.
And seeing that outbreak on your property, what does that mean to you, like having fought so hard for a tick-free zone?
Oh, it's just frustrating. It just frustrates the hell out of you because, you know, you don't expect it for a start. We've got a financial loss from the cattle we've lost. We've got a financial loss for what we have to treating. You know, we've had to treat everything with blood to stop the fever from spreading. And now we've got to go through an eradication program, which is, you know, at least 3 chemical treatments and then 3 clean inspections. Be 2 years before you can get you been back into the tick-free zone if everything goes good. Now, we might have a breakdown next year again, and you have to start again. And that's the thing, if those ticks are out there in neighbouring properties, that's where the government's got to come onto those properties and get a third party, like preferably a government employee, to come to each property and flee those cattle and make sure there is nothing on them.
Ivan Hay, a Central Queensland grazier, still coming to terms with the death of 18 head of cattle on 2 of his properties between Taroom and Wandowin in Central Queensland. Now, He still has a number of sick animals and is watching very closely the welfare of those animals. The chairman of AgForce's Cattle Tick Committee, Justin Boschhammer, says those deaths raise more questions than answers and highlights AgForce's view that there does need to be more data and coordination by authorities.
We just haven't been able to get the... Well, first of all, we want is data, and data around why they're outbreaking, how there's tick outbreaks occurring, and just better, take all the, for lack of a better word, secrecy out of it, and let's have more transparency, not so much just about the integrity of the line, but also creating greater awareness and education as a result, and try and learn how we best manage ticks going forward. Like, it's not as black and white as it could well be perceived, and that's been the frustrating part.
And why is that?
Because ticks mean ticks, and I don't know. I guess we're all different operators and whatnot. The movement around ticks out of the infested zone through into a sale yard and then potentially into a clean sale yard, there's a fair element of risk there around that protocol. You'd almost go to say, well, is that a good sayards themselves managing their GBO to make sure that they're not going to bring on infested cattle into a clean sayards? And if the current method is too risky for that, well, then they need to change what they're currently doing. You know, if you want to buy cattle out of a clean sayards, you'd like to think that they're going to be clean.
And what is AgForce's view of the way that the tick line is being controlled or enforced under the current rules?
It would be great for more beekeeper staff, and for a government that's, you know, got the highest number of public servants for some time, you'd have thought that this would be a great job opportunity, and the fact that we're seeing less and less resources just sort of flies in the face of what they're really about. And I would have thought it'd be more jobs for regional Queensland and get more people on the ground, and hopefully then that there's benefits then for industry and the wider economy and try and keep the ticks out of the clean zones.
For many, Justin Boschhammer, you'd be aware that the death of 18 head of cattle has really realised the worst fears of some producers who were raising concerns at the time that the rules were changed around the movement of cattle across the line. What's the message, or where to from here?
Yeah, well, it's certainly been ongoing, and unfortunately it may, like, a lot of producers were certainly venting their frustrations when the changes came in and said this would happen, and here we are. To be fair, there's always historically been some outbreaks. To what extent there's even greater outbreaks as a result of this legislative change, we're still unclear about. And that's the data we really need to make better decisions going forward. And because right at the moment, we're in an environment or a part of the year where you don't see tick outbreaks as such. I mean, we haven't had big wet.
So maybe if there were something good to come out of it, it might be a wake-up call for everyone, the government and producers.
We're all running businesses out here, and it's probably fair to say that us as producers need to take more care into what cattle we buy and what we introduce into our own environments and effectively manage our general biosecurity obligation. But that said, I mean, we haven't got the data around it to say how this all occurred, but if the incident proves or goes to show that movement from an infested zone through into a clean sale yard is too high risk, then we need to do something about the current legislation.
Justin Boschhammer from AgForce's Cattle Tick Committee speaking to me a short time ago about the deaths that have been incurred in a tick-free zone in central Queensland. Biosecurity Queensland, in a statement, has confirmed that it is currently investigating the detection of cattle ticks and a diagnosis of tick fever in livestock on those properties near Wandoan. Now, it's saying that there is nothing at this time to suggest that the infestation is a result of the new tick management framework introduced 2 years ago, and they have indicated that producers need to remain vigilant and ensure stock are free of cattle ticks when they are moving or being received. And we will, of course, keep you up to date of any developments in that ongoing investigation.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
25 past 12 on the Country Hour. And as we go to air today, the Chief Executive Officer and board members of Australia's largest cattle company, the Australian Cattle Company, AACo, are fronting their shareholders at a meeting in Brisbane. It would be interesting to be a fly on the wall in that meeting. I will do my best to try and bring you an update before we finish with the program today. But you would be aware that AACo's abattoir near Darwin officially stopped production last week, with meat workers clocking off for their final shift on Thursday. AACo has announced its plans already back in May to close that facility after admitting the $100 million beef processing facility was underperforming and costing the company millions of dollars. In a statement to the Country Hour, it said that around 100 employees have now been made redundant. A lot of those workers got together for last drinks at a pub in Darwin last week, and that's where the Country Hour's Matt Brand met up with Sophia Gibson, who worked in the boning room.
I actually really liked working there, so it's a sad story that's come to an end. Made a lot of good friends out there, had a lot of crazy fun at work. It's not your normal work environment, that's an absolute understatement, but lots of good fun, so yeah, it's just kind of sad it's come to an end now.
Tell us what a slicer does.
Slicer basically breaks down and takes away the fat from all the lumps of meat, like the briskets and the silver sides, and you know, you do your chuck tenders and your clods and things like that.
Tell us about the day you got the news that AACo was going to mothball the abattoir.
So we were all busy working away, and the management just came in and said, okay, everybody, knives down, take your gear off and go into the canteen, which we did. And everyone was kind of sitting down thinking, wow, what's going on? And then they made the announcement, and I think apart from the majority of us that were in shock, there were quite a few people that just broke down and cried.
What was that like for you?
A little bit of a slap in the face. Yeah. We just bought a property around the corner in Berry Springs in December, so working at AACo was perfect. It took me 8 minutes to get to work. It was really convenient. It was a sure thing. The hours didn't change. The pay was pretty good. So it was perfect. So I have another job now, but I have to travel like 45 minutes to get to work.
So, do you mind if I ask what you're doing now?
So I've got my certificates in horticulture. I'm just going back into the garden, and I'm going to be looking after the nursery in Bunnings.
Yeah, right.
So that's okay. Yeah, just means I have to travel to work now, and it takes me a long time to get to and from. But a job's a job, I guess.
But tell me about that last day, Thursday the 26th.
I always get to work a little bit early because I don't like having to hurry, so I go in and get changed and gear up and sharpen my knives and then kind of sit before everyone else comes in and you're at your workstation. And for the first time ever, I was just sitting there smiling to myself because everyone came in and everyone was really buzzy and smiling, and even the people that still normally look half asleep were wide awake with a kind of a grin. So it was it was really weird but really nice. Bittersweet, really, you know. Yeah.
You're all getting together at the Noonamah pub. How important is that?
Very important, because even when things were in full swing at work, the Noonie was kind of a meeting place for us because it's just down the road. It's a great country pub. We love it here. So it just seemed like the right place to have our breakup gathering. It's the place for us, and I think in future, like, we'll keep meeting here. I've made some really good friends. It's actually a little bit sad.
Yeah, you loved it, I can tell.
Yeah, I did. Anyway, I think everything comes to an end.
It's mothballed as of today. Do you think it'll ever make a comeback?
I think it's inevitable. It's a multi-million dollar establishment. It's not going to just sit there and go to waste. Not only that, about 4 or 5 weeks after they made the announcement, they put brand new speed humps in the car park. 8 days before the final day, they put up a new ashtray mounted on the wall. They're pouring concrete in an area outside the offal room. They've replaced a satellite dish out the back. They've put a boom gate in 8 days before closure. Yeah, I'm not buying it.
She's not buying it. That is Sophia Gibson, the former meat worker, one of about 100 former meat workers at AACo's Livingston Beef Facility outside of Darwin, speaking to Matt Brand there at the Noonimar Pub. The Noonie, the backdrop for those final drinks of the abattoir workers. In relation to that speculation that Sophia was delving into there, that perhaps the abattoir will soon reopen, you can read the comments that have been made by AACo. They're up on our website now if you'd like to search ABC Rural. I've also put in some requests this morning to speak with AACo's CEO, Hugh Killen, who has a bit on his plate at the moment, fronting shareholders at the company's AGM in Brisbane.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Where it is 12:30 and time to bring ourselves up to date with what's making news around the state. Good afternoon, Peter Scott.
G'day, Charlie. The Trade Minister says he's not expecting a backlash from China over a new pact between Australia, Japan and the US. They're joining forces in a trilateral partnership to invest in infrastructure projects in the Indo-Pacific. Steve Chobo has told Sky News it's not a response to Beijing's growing influence in the region. The Queensland Premier has arrived in Cairns ahead of a three-day tour of the Torres Strait Islands. Anastasia Palaszczuk's first stop will be Thursday Island, visiting a number of schools and health facilities. It's understood other issues to be addressed during the visit include water quality and climate change. And a rural lender has reassured its drought-affected clients they will be spared penalty interest rates with dry conditions set to continue into August. The National Australia Bank was the first to announce it would not apply higher interest rates on loans in default due to drought. Now, Rabobank has confirmed it will do the same, with the CEO saying his bank takes a long-term view on its clients' businesses and understands climatic extremes are part of being in the agricultural sector.
There you go.
More news coming up at one.
Thank you very much, Peter. And climate is exactly what we're talking about next, with Sam Campbell standing by at the Bureau of Meteorology. Sam, a pretty cool morning across many parts of regional Queensland, but it does seem to have warmed up now.
That's pretty much what's happening, Charlie. We got down to minus 4.5 around Wellcamp. That's just to the west of Toowoomba this morning. And minus 4.3 at Applethorpe down the southern border. So still plenty of cool air around for the southeast of the state and into tomorrow morning as well again. And temperatures drop below zero over a pretty broad area. So out as far to the west as Roma, up to the north around Miles, into areas to the east of Ipswich and right down to the New South Wales border. So pretty frosty morning through large parts of that southeast quarter of the state. But as you say, temperatures warming up to be near above average in most parts today, with the clear sunny skies persisting right through the state.
And how are we tracking for the maximum temperatures? It doesn't look like we're going to quite eclipse some of the records that were made around the Lockyer Valley and some parts of southern Queensland yesterday.
No, look, it might not be quite as hot there, but look, generally near above average temperatures, I'd say. So we're looking at temperatures getting up into the low 20s down the New South Wales border. Much of central Queensland, we're getting up to around 25 or 26 degrees. And up in the north, we could get some temperatures up around, say, 28 degrees around Charters Towers and 27 around Townsville. Townsville's pretty hot yesterday, of course, got up to 30 degrees there. That's about, I think, 5 degrees above the average for this time of year. So a touch cooler in the wake of that trough moving through, but still a pretty warm day in most parts today, Charlie.
Righto. And Sam, in terms of precipitation, you were pretty confident yesterday that there was nothing really on the horizon for today and tomorrow, but how are we looking beyond that?
Well, that's right. Dry conditions expected virtually throughout the entire state for today and tomorrow. Just the very slight chance, and by slight I'm talking about a 10% chance or so of 0.2 of a millimetre, and that's just around the eastern tropical coast north of about Cardwell. So, look, really very little there to get excited about. Thursday is more or less the same as well. Warming up in the west ahead of a surface trough, but just fine and sunny virtually throughout the state. Into Friday, unfortunately, there's not looking like any more rainfall with that next trough system we discussed yesterday as it comes through from the west. Just a slight chance of a shower around far the southern parts near the New South Wales border. But really, look, if you get more than 0.2 of a millimetre, you'd be quite lucky, and most people won't get anything at all with that system, I'm afraid, for Friday. Saturday and Sunday, generally fine conditions right through the state. And it's just that Monday that we're still a bit interested in that in terms of some rainfall perhaps coming back somewhere to the state. A lot of uncertainty. Some guidance is putting a band of showers and a bit of patchy rain over western Queensland. Some of it's putting over the far east coast. So the confidence is relatively low, I'm afraid. But there is still that potential. So there is going to be some moisture in the atmosphere for Monday. There will be an upper level trough coming through from the west and a surface trough. So we still think somewhere in Queensland on Monday there will be a little bit of rainfall, but just too early to say how much, Charlie, and where it's going to fall at this stage.
And Sam, we just heard in the news headlines that the Premier, Anastasia Palaszczuk, is about to spend a couple of days in the Torres Strait. I noticed that she'll be getting a typically windy Torres Strait welcome up there. How are the coastal waters conditions looking right around the state?
Well, generally for the Gulf waters and the waters north of St. Lawrence, generally southeasterly around 10 to 20 knots. But as you say, up in Torres Strait, it can just be a little bit breezier there. You could get some winds, perhaps getting up to 25 knots at times, those more exposed waters. The southern waters south of St. Lawrence, we're generally seeing winds around 10 to 15 knots, and again, from the southeast. So look, if you've got a boat, it's actually a pretty good time to take it out with fine conditions around and generally light winds for most people.
Righto, and what sort of winds will we likely to be see across the land over the next day or so?
Really light winds for the most part over much of Queensland, and we won't see winds picking up until Thursday ahead of that surface trough, so they'll be picking up. And then the Friday morning, it's probably worth mentioning, Charlie, in Friday morning in the far southwest of the state, so Birdsville and areas to the near Ballera and to the southwest of Ballera, there could actually be some pretty significant gusts during the morning with that trough system moving through. So we could be talking about some raised dust, could be talking about some gusts perhaps getting up to 60, 70 kilometres per hour with that trough system coming through. But that's really the only significant wind generator over land for the next while, I'd say, Charlie.
Sam Campbell from the Bureau of Meteorology, thanks for being with us on the Country Hour.
My pleasure, thanks.
He told me, the only person to change you is you. I listened.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
Eating disorder. A diagnosis. Deep down, something I'd longed for.
Haywire is looking for stories about what it's like growing up in regional Australia.
There are lots of dams where my family love to go swimming.
Winners get their story featured on the ABC and win an all-expenses-paid trip to the Haywire Regional Youth Summit in Canberra.
I met new people. I learnt new things.
Entries are open now. Go to abc.net.au/Haywire.
There's only 1 month of winter left. Some might even wonder if it's already escaping based on some of the maximum temperatures that we just heard Sam Campbell reporting. But it does mean that cattle producers are considering their next move ahead of spring, and particularly with the high likelihood now of an El Nino pattern setting in. Around the Mackay region, no one's seen much rain since February or March, and with a dry winter and frost following, any nutrients that were in the grass, well, they are all but gone now, and there isn't much water around either. John Kosica runs about 1,000 head on his station west of Mackay. He told our Tropical North rural reporter Lara Webster he's already sold off some of his cattle in case those talks of an El Nino prove true.
So we have some grass here. We're probably some of the lucky ones. We have some grass, but I don't think there's much value in the grass at all. We're on full urea licking, giving cattle supplement licking now. So the grass is just cardboard, really, I think, but this year there's not much value in it, but at least we have grass, I suppose. Once the rain stopped, it's just stopped. Yeah, we've had no runoff rain. We've got a lot of dry dams. And a lot of neighbours are frantically resurrecting all our bores and making sure they're all working properly, and because we're going to totally rely on bores later in the year, and we'll probably sort of are now already. A couple of dams are half full. None of our dams by washed, and 50% of them never had a drop run into them, so they're all bone dry.
What about your cattle? How are they looking at the moment?
I've tried to preempt a situation. I've got rid of most of my breeders, because if I get a dry year and if it becomes very dry later in the year, and our breeders are the hardest ones to move, to look after, and the hardest ones to get rid of. So I've virtually destocked all my breeder herd, and I've just got young weaner heifers here at the moment. I've replaced them with young weaner heifers. They're a hell of a lot easier to look after, and they get about a bit more. They walk for food a lot more. They walk up in the hills a bit. And if I get in trouble later in the year, I can throw them on a truck and get rid of them. Whereas the cows, I'm stuck with them.
Yeah, so you've already kind of put some plans in place should the year continue on as a dry one.
Yeah, for certainly have, yeah.
Are there any other plans that you're sort of starting to get together in case there isn't rain on the way?
No, just if they run out of water or grass, I'll just throw them on a truck and get rid of them, yeah.
At what?
That's the only plan.
At what point will you sort of make that decision?
Yeah, no, I'll see the signs there. If the boars start failing on me, for one, you know, well, you know, if you're running 150 head on a boar or whatever, and a boar fails somewhere, well, then I've got to accommodate it, haven't I?
John Kazika from Nebo speaking there. Meantime, livestock agent Paul Cooper says with the dry weather about, local producers are taking advantage of a lift in prices for heavier cattle and hanging on to their weaners instead.
There's been a little bit of an upsurge in the prices on offer, especially for feedlot cattle, feeder steers and feeder heifers, and I think people have taken the opportunity, and they're assessing the season going forward and take the opportunity to release a few cattle at pretty handy rates. The price bracket for the 350 to 450 kilo type of animal is sort of that $2.60 to $2.80 a kilo. And if they swing around and have a look at their weaner cattle, realistically, if they send them run a weaner cattle to the markets, 200 kilos, they go get the same price bracket. So people are saying, well, hang on, we'll sell an extra 150 or 200 kilos and get the same cents per kilo, and we'll keep our weaners back and we'll try and value add them and get them through to the rain.
And I am hearing the quality of the cattle's still pretty good, even though we are starting to lose body out of feed. What are you seeing?
Yeah, exactly that. And the graziers and the producers are seizing the opportunity while the cattle are looking the part, and they're assessing the feed's not going to be there going forward. The cattle look well now. The market's there for them. They're happy to pay reasonable money for them, and people will let them go. More so the weaner cattle are probably feeling the pinch. They're lacking that little bit of green pick that we would like to think we could have had or enjoyed this time of the year, but it's certainly not there at the moment. So the weaner cattle are probably feeling the pinch out of anything, and people are sort of keeping their weaners and letting a few older cattle go with a bit more condition on them.
Paul Cooper there, Landmark livestock agent, speaking with Lara Webster. You are listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 18 to 1. And a bit of a footnote on a story that you heard us bring you a couple of weeks ago now. A Woodford cattle stud owner. Well, she has been overwhelmed by the response to her emotional Facebook video. You might remember this one. She was threatening to shoot what she believed were domestic dogs attacking cattle on her property near Woodford. Sarah Eaton received a death threat, but she says the awareness that was raised in the whole result was worth it.
I still get a few people like, oh, I would have said nothing and just shot them. But in saying that, I posted the video out of frustration with the hope that someone who owns those dogs is going to realise, uh-oh, that's why my dogs have got blood on it. But in saying that, obviously the situation needed to be raised because there has been so many other instances that we've now heard about. It's obviously not the same dogs given the distance, but there's just that number of domestic dogs running loose. I ended up getting the death threat out of it, like my video, not off the news reports and that, off my video. So I sort of told that bloke where to go and blocked him on there. I was like, what an idiot. But yeah, it's been mostly positive. There's been a few vegan activists jump on there and say stupid stuff.
So death threat, were you concerned by that?
Oh, not really. He was some joker out of the city. It was probably a fake site.
What was the threat?
Oh, he was going to shoot me if I shot anyone's dogs or shot his dog again. And I was like, okay then, you're a little bit weird. There used to be an old tale. Dad used to say it, that when they did the dingo baiting, the signs did a better job than the baits themselves because people would lock their dogs up and you wouldn't get stray dogs. And to be honest, I think since I did that first video and then with all the news coverage, the owners have obviously got the guilt up and have done something with these dogs. I am confident I grazed the one with a shot, but in saying that, there was no dogs taken to the vets with that we know of with gunshot injury, so something's obviously happened, but the attacks have seemed to stop. So we're hoping that the coverage did what I was hoping it was going to do and made the owners realise just what their puppies were up to. We've had a lot of praise for actually getting the guts up and bringing a bit more spotlight on the situation, especially with the domestic situation, because the farmers have enough trouble with the wild dogs. They don't need people's pets getting out of control and going for a run and being bored. So I think it's done a lot of good on a few fronts to raise awareness about it.
Woodford cattle stud owner Sarah Eaton speaking there with Jennifer Nichols, happy to have highlighted the issue of not wild dogs. We're talking here about domestic dogs that had a go at two of her pregnant Hereford cows and a calf which died from its injuries after that attack. She's even happier, Jen tells me, to have welcomed a new calf out of one of those cows.
Got some energy now, Kakao. Back to Cleary backing up. He's over halfway. He had someone with him. And Wagga Blake, he's past them. He's over to score right under the post. Holy Nelly. Penrith score between the sticks through Wagga Blake.
ABC Grandstand.
ABC Grandstand.
Every exciting moment, the great tries, the big hits, every game, every weekend.
NRL.
NRL.
Grandstand NRL.
On ABC Radio Queensland.
AACo shareholders have had their first opportunity to front the board at its annual general meeting in Brisbane since the sale of its, or the closure, I should say, of its Darwin abattoir, the Livingston Beef Facility, which closed its doors last week. Australian agricultural company AACo is the country's biggest beef business, with a cattle herd of around 500,000 head on properties stretching right across Queensland and parts of Northern Australia. But it's been a pretty rugged year for AACo, one in which the company's been hemorrhaging money during a period of, well, historically high cattle prices. ABC TV's landline commodity watcher Kerry Lonigan has been our fly on the wall at today's proceedings in Brisbane. Kerry, what was the mood in the room?
Well, I must say the board and the chairman got off pretty much injury-free, because there are about 150, maybe more, shareholders and various people there. But there were very, very few questions that were tough, what you might say tough. There were questions on markets and branding. The questions about the Meatworks directed to Donald McGauchie were mainly about what's its future, and McGauchie made it quite clear it hadn't been closed, it had been simply mothballed, and they were hoping to sell it or maybe reopen it if the positions changed. I'd like to see that.
I saw the chairman, Don McGauchie's speech has been published, Kerry. He's been reassuring shareholders that after a period of transformation, he puts it that the green shoots are starting to appear for AACo. What are those green shoots? Where are they headed, Kerry?
Oh, he's talking about luxury markets overseas. I must say I've heard it all before, but look, it was amazing. After all the fracas about how appallingly AACo has done over the last couple of years, the questions from the shareholders were pretty tame or even lame. The most exciting, if you could call it exciting, came from a shareholder who was very concerned about climate change and the methane mitigation practices being assumed by the AACo. Well, I must say the whole board or the whole room was stunned by this, but McGauchie handled it pretty well and pointed out that everything was under consideration. But there were hardly any questions about corporate responsibility, about do you feel any contrition about all the losses that you've put into shareholders over recent years. Hardly, they got off without a scratch.
And no pointed questions, I'm assuming, from what you're saying about the pay rises that the board members themselves approved.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was one or two, but one question, I beg your pardon, and that was almost popped off, saying that the pay rises are no more than they have been in recent years, et cetera, et cetera. The board members up for re-election, Donald McGauchie, he was re-elected with 80.6% or 81% of the vote. David Crombie was re-elected with 83% support. And Jessica Rudd, the new member, the only female on the board, she was re-elected with 95% support.
Well, that would suggest that things are going along pretty nicely according to shareholders. What about the future of AACo's Livingston Beef Facility? How long does the company think it'll take to recover from the losses it incurred in that venture?
Well, those were questions I put to the Managing Director, Hugh Killen. That interview will be on Landline on Sunday. But he more or less said, look, it's a work in progress. And he's hopeful of doing things sooner rather than later. But look, with cattle prices the way they are now, it shouldn't be too long before they turn it around. But look, they've had 500,000 head in one of the most dynamic markets for the last several decades, and they haven't been able to make any money. So I'm not holding out any promises until I see it in writing.
Well, Kerry, if the shareholders let them get off scot-free, I'm sure that you've made amends for that. We'll look forward to hearing the insights that you've gained on ABC TV's Landline program this Sunday at 12:30.
Thank you, Charlie.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, we've certainly heard a lot about trying to deal with the issue of food waste in the horticulture industry. And it's fourth-generation fruit wholesalers, Anthony and Paul Joseph, who have taken up the challenge. The duo recently launched a new digital trading platform in a bid to give growers, buyers and merchants access to live sales and real-time market data. Anthony Joseph says that they are hoping that this new technology will help to stop oversupply and change the market space where demand is driving supply.
Phoenicia has been developed for the horticultural industry in Australia to overcome the supply chain challenges we face today. By providing real-time access to market data and visibility on supply and demand, and you know, providing a critical pathway to the long-term sustainability of the industry, we believe.
And when did you come up with the idea to create this digital platform?
As a family, we've been involved in the horticultural sector, in the horticultural industry for over 100 years here in Australia. And in the last 43 years through our trading business, at Alfred E. Chave at the Brisbane Markets, we deeply understand the challenges that the industry faces, and having an awareness of what technology was available. For us, we began investigating what we could do to perhaps change the way we do business and set us on a path to, you know, a more sustainable future in the industry.
And it sort of like connects growers, buyers and merchants. How exactly do they benefit from this platform?
Well, in this day and age, we've seen an evolution of the supply chain over the last 50 years globally, and, you know, taking into account things like transport, warehousing, purchasing and marketing, financing the actual trade through to the end consumer. And as this supply chain has evolved, you know, and technology has developed over the years, if you think about the advent of computers, fax machines, mobile phones, we now have this situation where the supply chain really needs to go to the next level so that we can start to consolidate some of that information, create cost savings in the way we do business, and provide information to our producers and our customers in real time so that, you know, they can enjoy the benefits of that as well.
And Anthony, what are some of the major challenges you see in the horticultural industry in Australia which Phoenicia can address?
First and foremost, it's starting a completely different conversation. The industry will be able to come together and have conversations about real, validated information, and all of a sudden our ability to actually then address challenges in the industry will be directly driven by supply and demand, as opposed to, you know, what markets are doing or what export markets are doing, what supermarkets might be paying, what the markets might be paying. So it's about consolidating that information to drive that change into the future.
Does that allow growers then as well to adapt to the market? Like, as you mentioned, it's real-time data. Does that allow them then to sort of adapt their growing patterns to that market better?
Yeah, well, one thing we've actually found as we've been on this journey is real-time, transparent information is quite confronting and challenging to understand, particularly from the grower's side. If you can imagine that growers have done business a certain way for 20, 30, 40 years and have interpreted the existing information out of the market from multiple sources, different states, supermarkets, export markets, and then with that information, they then drive their decision-making process around how they commercialise their crop or what they produce the next season. Having the actual information is like a completely different language, and it's been quite challenging for us to actually work with our growers initially so that they can actually understand the difference in the information, and that we have to overlay this information with a whole different set of decision-making processes as opposed to how we may have done it in the past. there's a big change for everybody involved. But at the end of the day, what we have is real information. So we can actually look at who our customers are. And then, you know, that might drive decisions around what products we grow next year, what volume of certain products, crops and commodities, so that we're actually getting the situation where the demand is driving the supply, as opposed to the unfortunate situation at the moment here in Australia where supply is driving demand.
In regards to reducing food waste, does this new digital platform contribute to that?
Yeah, so when we talk about waste today, the general population will think about potentially what we're throwing out at home, what we don't eat, what gets thrown out or wasted physically in the market. The real opportunity from a waste point of view, we feel, is that by having the ability to make more informed decisions faster, that waste that goes unnoticed in the supply chain because produce isn't harvested at the right time or it misses markets as a result, we're able to capture that latent waste that just gets hidden, which will actually drive further, allow the growers to be more profitable by taking waste out of the supply chain that's there at the moment.
That is Anthony Joseph, the co-founder of Phoenicia, a new digital trading platform which he hopes will change the marketing space in the horticulture sector. It just goes to show the types of innovation that are being adopted right through the supply chain to try and tackle that issue of oversupply and unnecessary food waste. Time to check the markets now, and the over-the-hook indicators have dipped in Queensland for the first time in several months. To give us the details, here's the MLA's Phoebe Johnson.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Queensland over-the-hook indicators have eased for the first time since May, with cows and bulls seeing the greatest change, decreasing by 8 to 11 cents a kilo. Across the state, yearling steers between 240 and 260 kilos average 483 cents, while heavy yearling steers above 300 kilos average 498, and heavy MSA yearling steers average 509 cents. Heavy MSA 70-day grain-fed yearling steers average 540, while MSA 100-day grain-fed lines over 300 kilos average 544. Medium-weight grown steers Norton 4-tooth average 480, while heavy grown steers Norton 4-tooth average 491 cents. Top of the heavy cow indicators finished at 421 cents this week, while good condition cows from 240 to 260 kilos average 406 cents per kilo carcass weight. This has been Phoebe Johnson for Meat and Livestock Australia.
Numbers back at the Roma store sale today as well, where Trevor Hess has all the quotes for us.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Numbers reduced by 3,100 head to 5,100 at the Roma store sale today. Some extra competition combined with a small improvement in quality resulted in lightweight yearling steers to restockers or backgrounders averaging 11 to 26 cents dearer, while medium and heavyweight yearling steers to feed generally remain within a few cents either way of the previous sale. Lightweight yearling steers returning to paddock made the 300.2 to average 282. Yearling steers in the 280 to 330 kilo range made the 298.2 to average 284. Medium-weight yearling steers to feed average 286 and made the 294.2, and heavyweight yearling steers over 400 kilos to feed average 287 and made to 296.2. Lightweight bulls to restockers sold from 240 to 282.2, and there's around 1,600 heifers and 800 cows left to sell. And I'll have a full report in the morning. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
A smaller yarding also gathered at the Warwick sale yards today, where, Doug Robson, watching the prices for us there.
Main reduction was in young cattle and a few less cows. Quality was plainer in a cheaper market. Restocker weaner steers were 10 cents cheaper, selling up to 262. Good quality background steers met a strong market, however. They topped at 288 to average 264. Feeder steers were back by 7 to 14 cents. Medium weight sold up to 295 to average 274. And heavy feeder steers topped at 286. Trade steers, they sold up to 288. Light yearling heifers were the hardest hit in the price fall, ranging from 10 to 30 cents cheaper, some places more. They ranged from 110 to 220 cents, most sales under $2. Feeder heifers down by 8 cents to average 238, and trade heifers sold up to 272. Bullocks and steers were 20 to 30 cents cheaper, 223 to 274, and grown heifers topped at 249. Cow market was backed by 12 to 14 cents, light cows more. one and two scores, 90 cents to 181. Medium weight cows average 199, and heavy cows off from 201 to 234. This is Doug Robson at Warwick.
And just recapping our top story, a Gold Coast bait supplier has become the first to be prosecuted for moving raw prawns outside of a movement restriction area imposed to stop the spread of white spot. You can find more details of that story online at abc.net.au/rural. Listen back to the Country Hour. You can find our podcast on the website, or stay tuned and join me again tomorrow from noon. Have a wonderful afternoon.